Offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and as always, I have the pleasure of being seated in this beautiful studio at Prashanthi Nilayam, the place where Swami himself graced, and to speak to you all live, week after week, and especially on this very beautiful theme of the Bhagavad Gita. As you all know, this is a program where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse, try to go through it as detailed as possible, the various explanations, the understandings that we can gain from it, and most importantly, as much as possible, to reference it with what Swami has taught us. And I hope you all will agree with me that this is such a beautiful work, such a profound work. Its practical application in our everyday life is so very direct. And I can't help myself that every time, whenever we have an interaction with youth or interaction with people who ask us questions on spirituality, how to lead a spiritual life, we always gravitate towards this text. And that's how beautiful and how useful it is for a spiritual minded person. For it has answers to all our questions, especially about practical spirituality, how to lead our lives in a manner that it reflects our spiritual aspirations. We are still in the third chapter, and we are in the second half of the third chapter, if I can put it that way. The verses that we covered last time around were verses 26, 27 and 28. So we will go back to them. We'll have a quick summary of those verses, and then we'll progress into today's verse. In verse number 26, Krishna spoke about how the wise should not disturb the unwise. He said that they should not be unsettled. And how does one do that? How does, not you and me, how does a jnani do that? He must or she must do their karma in a very diligent manner. Just like how someone who is very keen on the results of their actions would do. That's again a verse which Krishna had said some time back, where he said just like how a regular person interested in the consequences of his actions would act, in the same manner a jnani must act, only without the same attachment. So it's a repeat of that, where Krishna is re-emphasizing that one should not, in fact, the verse that we're going to start with today also will be a repeat of this particular thing, what Krishna is saying, that the ajnani should not be disturbed by a jnani. Well, it is not to say that the ajnani or the unwise one must be kept in the dark, but through the path that this person walks, he must be led and slowly transformed. It's pretty much like how you wouldn't give a tool, something like a surgeon's knife, to a person who is uninitiated, right? Let's say there's a student in a fifth grade or sixth grade. You might want that person to be a doctor, or you might want that person to become a surgeon. It doesn't mean that you give the surgical equipments or implements to a child of that age. You allow the child to grow in that particular school where he's studying through the educational process. Wait till he graduates till the point where he deserves to be given that surgical equipment, and then he takes on that path. So it is not that he should be kept in the darkness, but going along the same path, the person has to be made suitable to receive that knowledge. Because as Krishna had said before, jnana cannot be achieved by doing anything. Jnana cannot be achieved by not doing too. Jnana is only conferred on a mind which is prepared to receive that knowledge. And how is the mind prepared? When it attains the state of Chitta Shuddhi, when the mind is purified. And how is the mind purified? It is through actions which are in consonance with dharma. When a person does his duty, does it well, does it diligently, and does it within the moral code, right? So when a person is there who is going through life with his likes and dislikes, with his aspirations, with his ambitions, instead of disturbing that person from that path and giving him this jnana which he is not prepared for, he should be led to do his work in a manner as unattached as possible, as undisturbed from the moral codes as possible, And then eventually he or she becomes prepared to receive the jnana. So that's what Krishna means when he says the unwise should not be disturbed, but the unwise should be taken along the same path till they are ready to receive. Verse 27 was a little different, and I had given a particular interpretation for that. Krishna speaks about the three gunas. He says that whatever a normal person does is nothing but a result of the imbalance of the three gunas. We spoke about the three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas, very briefly. And we spoke of how in most situations, the way we act is being inspired, or we are being propelled to act in that manner by the three gunas. We think that we are getting angry at a person, but we don't know how much the other person is in control of our anger. It's more than we are in control of it. Sometimes we think that we look at something and we aspire for it, but it is the situation which creates that aspiration in us. So in many ways, we are not in control of ourselves. And Krishna was making a reference to that and saying that everything that we perform, every emotion that we express is nothing but the three gunas playing about. But an unwise person imagines that he is the one who is reacting, he is the one who is choosing, he is the one who is making decisions, and he gets deluded in this manner. And in the next one, in verse number 28, Krishna contrasts this with a jnani, contrasts this with a person who has the wisdom, and he says, but the wisdom, the wise one, never thinks in this manner. He always knows that this body is made of prakriti, it's part of nature, it's part of prakriti, it is made of the gunas, and not for a moment he ever deludes himself into thinking that he or she is the body, right? And that's the difference. So Krishna went on to say that he lets the body be an expression of the three gunas, as the story that I narrated the last time about a great master who said that when the body is thirsty, it drinks water. When the body is tired, it goes to sleep. I have nothing to do with that. It is not me who is drinking. It's not me who is sleeping. Because a jnani constantly and very, very clearly differentiates the self from the body. And when that discrimination or when that wisdom is so steady, what we refer to as jnana nishtha, the steady wisdom of such, when a person has, he does not get attached to the actions, right? He remains unattached. So that was the verse number 28. And as I said, verse number 29 is actually a repetition of the theme which Krishna spoke in verse number 27. But of course, there is always a little more to talk about it. So we will first listen to the verse number 29 of third chapter in the voice of Brother Shyam, who has very beautifully and clearly rendered it for us. And after that, I'll give you a brief meaning and we'll discuss about that in detail.
Prakriter guna sammoodha sajjante guna karmasu tana krishna vido mandan krishna vinna vichalayet.
Those who are wholly deluded by the gunas of nature become attached to the activities of the gunas. The knower of all should not disturb those of dull intellect who do not know the all. If you look at it, these are all different ways of explaining the nature of a wise person. And as we've seen in the second chapter, it's very, very difficult to explain or to describe wisdom itself. And Arjuna himself recognizes this fact, and that's why he asks about the traits of a wise man. So that seems to be the best way to explain the nature of wisdom itself. And even in the past few verses, we've seen that the explanation that Krishna is giving is based on the gunas. It's one more way of explaining the nature of a wise person. Here Krishna says, prakriter guna sammoodaha, those that are completely deluded by prakriter gunaihi. This prakriti and gunas interplay, prakriter gunaihi, sajjante guna karmasu. Such people get attached to the actions that are inspired by these gunas. And as I mentioned earlier, when we say attached to actions, it means attached to the consequences of those actions. Now, imagine, I think as children, most of us would have played some of these board games like Monopoly, or in India we used to call it the trade game, right? And I'm sure most of the children, even the current generation, must be playing those games. It always has this fake money. There are some small fake homes which you can buy, and there are some property that you can buy. And some of these Indian games, you can buy the states, you can buy railways, you can buy the different things. It's a game of business and trade where you kind of accumulate money, which is of course within the game, and then you buy different property, and then you kind of see who ends up as richer than the other. Some kind of a game like that. I'm sure there must be a version of that in each country, if not Monopoly itself. If you really look at it, when we were children, you know, when you play that game, when you win a lot of money or when you're able to buy something, we would be jumping in joy and saying that, oh, you know, I've become richer than you, or I've got this, or I've bought this airport. We would get very competitive. We would, you know, get into the game and we would enjoy that. But the money that we actually have in the game has no value outside the game. The people sitting there have chosen to give value to that paper or cardboard money which we are playing with, right? And with that comes the excitement. The paper or that cardboard does not have any value of its own. The toy homes which are there and those cards which are there, they do not have any value of their own. But five people come together, sit around that board, and they decide that this is the value we give to this money, and this is how we play. And along with that comes the feeling that I have won, you have lost, I've made money, I've made profit, and all of that. If you look at something a little larger, we used to have these collection games, you know, where you have these cards which would have the name and the achievements of, say, a cricket player or a football player or a wrestler. And these cards used to be a craze when we were in school. You had to collect these cards, and there would be this contest as to who has the maximum number of cards and who has got the cards with the higher, those with the higher ranking and all of that, right? And this would be very similar to a card game, a board game like Monopoly, but you have a larger number of people giving a certain value to these cards, which are actually collectibles, right? And sometimes in school, you would have these children who trade those cards. They would buy it from each other. They would barter it with expensive pens and expensive other objects, right? It's because, again, the value that the people who are involved in that game or involved in the collection give to those objects, they do not have any value of their own. And for all the others, it might seem very, very silly and meaningless. They will not be able to relate to the emotions which go along with the collection or that playing of that game. And those that are into it will look at those people who are uninterested and tell them that you'll never know, right? This is so much fun and you'll never know that. Now imagine a game of Monopoly where the whole world plays together. Now the whole world begins to value that paper currency that you're playing with. The whole world starts valuing the property that you buy within that game, the toy aeroplanes and the stuff, all that goes with that. Imagine the whole world of 7 billion people choose to start giving value. When you sit and play that board game, probably there are 4 people or 6 people who give value to that money. Now imagine a Monopoly game where 7 billion people decide to give the same value to that game, to that paper money that you're playing with. Well, that is what is the real world, isn't it? Everything in this world does not have an absolute value. It is you and I who choose to give it that value. If you take a $500 bill or 500 rupees, the value-wise it might be different, but it's at the end of the day 2 pieces of paper and nothing more than that. It is we who invest that value in that piece of paper and say that, and this is so much and I can buy so much with this, or this is what is the value of these things, right? Which means they do not have an absolute value, and people come together and choose to give it value, and then starts off the excitement of how much more do I have and how much more do you have, right? So this world of all things to which we add value is what is referred to as prakriti. That is what Krishna is speaking about in this verse and the previous verses. And we are getting lost in it, and we decide all our actions based on these objects only because we give it importance. They otherwise don't deserve that importance at all. I hope you understand the drift of this. It's like you playing a game of Monopoly and you get so involved in it and you start making all decisions, you start making friends within that group and you start getting angry with some people, all based on this fake currency that you and I have chosen to give importance to. It does not have any value of its own. Now this whole world is like that. It does not have value of its own. We invest value in it. We choose to give it value. And then we get lost in it. Then we start fighting. Then we start getting angry. Then we start getting jealous. And all of these emotions start dictating our actions. So when we see something which is not there, say like a mirage, like when we hallucinate, that is precisely what we are doing with the property and all this wealth in this world. It does not have a value, and we are seeing a value where there is none. So it's almost like a mirage, our interaction with a mirage. So here we see as valuable which is really not valuable. That is why prakritir guna sammudaha, those that are deluded by this prakriti guna world, because the whole thing is prakriti and guna play. It does not have any value. It is you and I who are in reality the self, the purusha. We give it importance and it becomes important, right? And when we give it importance and we get lost in it, it becomes prakritir guna sammudaha. We get deluded in this world of prakriti. And when deluded, we run after prakriti guna objects and thereby get attached to the karmas which are qualified by the gunas. Sajjante guna karmasu. So here is this world of prakriti. I give it importance. I get deluded in this importance that I have given it by my will and all the other people involved in it. And I get so lost in it, now they start deciding how I act. Now when I start giving importance to a luxury car, it is nothing but another form of a prakriti guna object, just like the whole world. But I give it more importance than an ordinary car. And when I do that, now I start doing actions which will enable me to procure that, let's say. And I start getting attached to those actions which are tuned towards the prakriti guna objects. And that's what Krishna says, sajjante guna karmasu. Those who are deluded in this prakriti guna world get attached to actions which are based on gunas. Tan, those, akritsna vidho mandan, kritsna vid na vichalayet. In the second verse, Krishna says, tan akritsna vidho mandan, kritsna vid na vichalayet. A word and its antonym is being used here. It says kritsnavid, akritsnavid. The word kritsna means the whole, and akritsna means incomplete or not seeing the whole. So Krishna is saying kritsnavid. Vid means knowledge, right? So kritsnavid means the one who has complete or whole knowledge, and akritsnavid means a person with incomplete knowledge. So he says, akritsna vidho mandan, those that have incomplete knowledge, mandan, who lack discrimination. The word mandan means those who do not have discrimination. Kritsna vid na vichalayet, those with complete knowledge must not agitate their understanding. Rather, they must be led along the path and should be helped to gain the same knowledge. As I said, it's a repetition of what Krishna categorically said in verse number 27. There was this very beautiful story my father used to tell me when I was a kid. It is a story of a man who goes out into the ocean sailing, and his ship is wrecked and he's thrown into the waters, and eventually he is washed ashore, this very lonely island which nobody has heard of before. So he gets up there, when he's once back into his senses, he starts going around and then he meets a local person and he realizes that this person whom he meets is visually impaired. He's not able to see. And then he introduces him to his other friends and, you know, slowly he starts meeting people one after the other. And then he realizes that every person that he was meeting were actually blind. And very soon he realizes that the whole island is filled with blind people. Not one of them are able to see. So when they figure out that this person who has been washed ashore is able to see, they suddenly look at him as some, you know, a superhuman person who has come. Because everybody in this island, probably a few thousands, a few hundreds of thousands of people, all are blind, and there is this one person who has this superhuman, according to them, ability to see things, right? So instantly he becomes very famous. They start celebrating him. They take him around the island. They show him different kind of things, and they're kind of giving him the best hospitality of theirs. And they take him to one particular place and they show him a particular tree and they tell him that, you know, you should never go near this tree. The fruits of this tree are very, very poisonous. So none of us go near that tree. So since you're here and we're hoping that you'll be here for a while, we are showing you this tree. Ensure that you never go near this tree and never eat the fruits of this tree because they're poisonous. So he makes a note of it and he decides that he'll never go near that tree. Then eventually the news spreads and it reaches the king of the land. And the king comes to know that there is a person here with this superhuman ability to see. Because none of them have, not only is all of them blind, none of them have ever seen. It's being blind is a natural phenomenon in that island. So when they see a person who is able to see, they see him as a person who has this supernatural ability. So he's brought to the king's court. The king looks at him with much honor and everything. And the king invites him for a feast. And when he sits with the king for this feast, there is this special fruit which is brought. And the king tells him that this is the, you know, the traditional fruit of our village, of this island, and all of us feast on this. And this is the first thing that we give the children who are born in our families. It's supposed to be very sacred. We look at it as this and that, and all of that has been given. And this fruit is served to this man. And this man very happily relishes the feast. He goes to sleep, and when he wakes up the next morning, he wakes up a blind man. And he is shocked. He doesn't know what to do, and he's going around, and the moment he becomes blind, and everybody looks at him and says, okay, now you become one of us. You know, now you don't have anything special, right? So slowly, he kind of loses the favor that he had with the people, and he roams around like a regular person. But he starts wondering what happened. What did he do that made him lose his sight? And then he gets an inkling. Probably it could be because of the fruit that was served during the banquet. Because from the description they gave, everyone seems to be eating that fruit, and possibly that fruit is causing the blindness, is what he thought. And then he wonders about this fruit, which they all said was a poisonous fruit. So what they thought was their most sacred fruit made him blind. So he wondered what would the poisonous fruit be like. Then he decided to experiment. He said, already I'm blind, and if I were to die, so be it. But let me find out. So he goes to this forbidden tree and he picks up this poisonous forbidden fruit and he eats it. Nothing happens. And he says, probably, you know, they just have some kind of a superstition about this tree, and this seems to be a normal tree. In the next morning, he wakes up and he realizes that his sight is back. And instantly, he recognizes this poisonous tree as the tree that has the ability to give back sight. Whereas that tree, which all of these people thought was their sacred tree or their staple diet, was actually making them blind. So once he finds this out, he tries to go around and tell all the people of the island that, you know, this is what it is. The fruit that you think is sacred is actually the wrong fruit, and the fruit that you think is poisonous is the fruit that you should all have. And when he says this, you know, people are so attached to that sacred tree and that sacred fruit that they start, you know, making fun of him, and they feel that he's a traitor and they don't listen to him. And so the story goes that he begins to live along with them. he does not reveal the fact that he is actually able to see. He lives with them just like them and eventually wins their confidence and then manages to get a few people to taste the forbidden fruit. And once they get back their vision and once he has the numbers and he finally convinces everybody in the island that they should stop eating the poisonous fruit and they should start eating the fruit which they thought was poisonous but was in fact the cure for their blindness. Now, this story is so much like our state in the world today, isn't it? We all are blinded because of our indulging in this fruit of worldliness. And we find it the tastiest fruit and we really celebrate it. But we are so lost in it that if someone were to come and give us advice that this is not the right thing, you will have to try out. Don't stop indulging in the fruit of karma. Start indulging in the fruit of karma yoga. We probably will not be in the right mindset to accept it. Or we might look at the person and say that you must be mad or you must be saying something which is not true. Either people will blindly follow them and get into trouble, like in the case of here, because it's not in the story I'm telling, in the real life as Krishna has been telling, a person who is doing regular karma would do the mistake of taking up inaction if he sees a jnani in inaction. So one problem is they might blindly follow and that could get them into trouble, or they will dismiss the advice itself as being unacceptable. So the jnani, the kritsnavid, the one who has the ability to have the complete vision, must earn the confidence of the akritsnavid, those who do not have that complete vision. Live with them, live like them, and slowly lead them to deliverance. And this is for their own good, and it is not to keep them in ignorance, and the jnani does not gain anything from that, just like that man in the island. He does not gain anything by the others being blind or having vision. But it's just out of that goodwill, as Krishna said before, with the aspiration for the overall welfare of the world, a jnani acts. So in that sense, this is the explanation that Krishna gives, that a person of wisdom will have to act and live like a person who is not wise, to win their confidence and to direct them in the right path. And just as I said in the introduction, there is nothing that can be done or nothing that can be given up which will give us jnana. It is not something which can be earned in any manner. The mind can only be prepared so that it is ready to receive that jnana. And for that, the path is the path of good karma to start with. So when a person of raga and dvesha is already doing action, you do not disturb him from that, but you lead him along. And that's what Krishna says. So that's verse number 29. We'll listen to verse number 30. I'll give a brief meaning after that. We'll discuss about verse number 30 of chapter 3 after that.
Mayi sarvani karmani sanyasyadhyatmachetasa nirashir nirmamo bhutva yudhyasva vigatajvaraha.
Therefore, surrendering thy actions unto me, thy thoughts concentrated on the absolute, free from selfishness, and without anticipation of reward, with mind devoid of excitement, begin thou to fight. So this is verse number 30. This is a verse where Krishna is literally summarizing what karma yoga is. A beautiful, crisp definition of what is karma yoga. The one point that was not mentioned so far for a considerable time is also mentioned in this particular verse. And what is that? Dedicating all actions to the Lord. Here Krishna says yuddhasva, which means he says fight. He's telling Arjuna to fight. And as we've seen many times, Krishna keeps reminding Arjuna and of course us readers too as to what is the context of the discourse of the Gita. And in many places, randomly we have come across this and suddenly Krishna would say, Therefore, Arjuna, take part in the battle. Therefore, Arjuna, you must fight. So this is to suggest that this is the context. So this whole discourse is to make Arjuna fight. And if you were to make it, give it a more generalized idea, we can say that Krishna is trying to make Arjuna do something which he is supposed to do, but he is not inclined to do, right? When we say Krishna is asking Arjuna to fight, it is not about the fighting, it is not about the war, it is not about the bloodshed, but here is a warrior whose duty is to take part in the battle. So this is his duty, and he is not inclined to do his duty. So when in a situation, which is likely to, when in such a situation which is likely to come in all our lives, right, how must we act? Or even if it is a duty that we particularly like, we are very fond of, if we wish to be a karma yogi, how must we act? So whether it's a duty that I'm not fond of and I don't want to do, or whether it's a duty that I'm fond of, I would like to do, if I wish to be a karma yogi, there is a certain approach that I must have. And that is being summarized by Krishna in this particular verse. So when in a he starts in this particular shloka by saying, Mai sarvani karmani, unto me may all your actions be dedicated. So do whatever you do as an offering to me. As I said, this is a point that has not been mentioned for a while. And also what makes karma yoga most effective is this attitude of doing actions as an offering to God. Of course, Krishna did mention about doing all our actions like a yajna, right? That's something that we have come across, and how looking at all of these forces of nature as a deity, and you're making whatever you do as an offering, that's one thing. But here he is categorically saying, offer it to me. Krishna is saying, he's telling Arjuna, take part in the war and offer all your actions to me. So needless to say, what is the prerequisite for this attitude, for one to do whatever one does as an offering to God? The most important thing is faith. Faith in the Lord is the important prerequisite for this. And that's something that Krishna is also going to speak about in the next verse. So we'll discuss that when we come there. There are plenty of reasons for us to take up actions. And these actions decide, or these reasons decide, how the actions themselves will be performed. For example, how desperate I will be, or how corrupt I am ready to become, or how aggressive against others I could be. All of this is decided by, for what am I doing that action? Or sometimes we may want something, we might aspire for something, but there is only a certain cost we are ready to pay. For example, there might be someone who wants to, say, make a lot of money or make a big name in business. But let's say when that person sees that it is taking away too much time from him or her, from the family, that person might decide that it's not worth it. They might be prepared to let go. So what we perform an action for, the purpose behind it, in many ways defines how and with what attitude we will perform that action. So here Krishna is saying, do it for me, which means make the purpose of your action me. Make offering your actions to me as the purpose of your action. And this brings with it a host of qualities. Firstly, if I want to offer my action to Swami, it cannot be immoral. It cannot be something which is wrong or which hurts another person. I cannot be rude, unkind or hurting and say I am doing it for Swami. We can be firm and strict. That's a different thing. Swami says a teacher must be firm and strict, a parent must be firm and strict. But we cannot speak in a manner we belittle another person, we hurt another person in the course of something that we do in the name of seva and say that I am offering this to Swami. When you say that I am performing my action as an offering to Swami, it goes without saying that that action must be good action. I recall once when Swami was giving a discourse and Swami started speaking about one of the senior staff in Swami's ashram. And this person had served Swami for a very, very long time, many, many years, and Swami was in fact praising him for that service that he had done. But as a person, he was probably not the most pleasant person that you'll come across. He was very rude, he had hurt a lot of people, he had troubled a lot of people. Quite a few people were pushed to, you know, frustration, and they eventually left this place and went because of what he did. So not a very pleasant personality in that sense, but had served Swami for many, many years. And Swami was, you know, praising him for the many years that he had dedicated to Swami. And something that Swami said that day was very, very striking. And I recall exchanging notes with some of my other friends who were also part of that discourse that day. We were all listening to that discourse. Swami said very, very clearly, he said, this person has done so much service and, you know, he has done for so many years. And then Swami said, he has done a lot of service and he has done it to his satisfaction. And we found that very, very odd. We would want Swami to say that you have done it to my satisfaction. But here was Swami who was saying that he has done it to his satisfaction. Well, of course, Swami has said on other occasions that if you do it for your satisfaction, it is as well as doing it for my satisfaction, because the self is same as me. But for when we were hearing it, probably we were biased because of the person and knowing that person. But this was the first idea that we got, that Swami is saying that this person did it to his satisfaction. And a lot of us who were sitting there felt that Swami's remark was very, very clear. Now, this is what we don't want to do. We might do all our actions and offer it to Swami, and we might be very satisfied with the way we are doing it. But if we really want it to be an offering to Swami, the question that we must obsess ourselves with is it to Swami's satisfaction, right? Because many times we do it the way we like, the way we think is right. But then that is not karma yoga. That again becomes regular karma, right? So Krishna is saying, Mai sarvani karmani, do whatever you do unto me. So that is the important point about this, that when you do whatever you do as an offering to me, one of the first things that should happen is it cannot cross the line of morality. It cannot cross the idea of goodness, what Swami speaks of. Don't hurt another person. Don't belittle another person. Don't, you know, if something can be told politely, tell it politely. If something can be done without troubling others, do it without troubling others. All of these things are, for that matter, even the quality of unity. All of this, what is important to Swami, should become important to the person who is doing an action if he or she wants to make it an offering to God. And then he goes on to say,
Sanyasya Adhyatma Chetasa. Sanyasya Adhyatma Chetasa. Sanyasya means with renunciation. Adhyatma Chetasa means with a mind fixed on spirituality or on the absolute. Till now we saw that Krishna was dissuading Arjuna from sannyasa, right? Because Arjuna wanted to become a sannyasi, and the whole discourse is about Krishna telling him that that's not the right option. But now he is saying renounce. He is saying sannyasya. You take up the attitude of renunciation. But that is not what Krishna is saying here, because if we were to look at it, what is all this leading to? What is he leading to in this particular verse itself? It is all leading to the word yudhyasva, to fight. And as we saw, generalizing it means do your duty. So if we were to construct that whole sentence to add these words sanyasya adhyatma chetasa and yudhasva, it becomes sanyasya adhyatma chetasa bhuktva yudhasva, which means fight with an attitude of renunciation and a mind that is fixed on the spiritual. That's what it means. It does not mean renounce and have your mind fixed on the absolute. With a mind fixed on the absolute and with an attitude of renunciation, do what you're supposed to do is what it means. So what has to be renounced? Well, Krishna has been saying it again and again, and I'm sure I've been saying it again and again. You all must be knowing it. The results of the action have to be renounced. the attachment to specific outcomes of the actions that we perform have to be renounced. If we ever happen to have doubts what Krishna is talking about here, Krishna reiterates it in the very next line itself. He says, Nirashihi Nirmamo. Nirashihi Nirmamo. He says, these are the qualities with which you must perform your action. Nirashihi. The word asha means aspirations or hope. So one of the meanings of nirasha means hopelessness. But that's not what Krishna is telling Arjuna to be. He's not telling Arjuna act hopelessly. Asha also means looking forward to something. When you have an aspiration that you're looking forward to in the future. So when you have some desire, you're looking for the fulfillment of that desire in the future. So when Krishna is saying nirashihi, it means act without any such expectations from the future. Nirmamo, without the feeling of mindness. Well, this is again something that we've discussed. The feeling of mind is certainly required to define our duty. When I say this is my family, there is a certain duty that gets attached to that, and that is, it defines what I'm supposed to do. When I say this is my profession, it entails a certain duty. In fact, when I say my duty, that itself is a form of mamatvam, right? So when Krishna says nirmamo, it is not giving up this feeling entirely. I will not be able to define my duty clearly if I give up this idea completely. So when this mindness, when this idea of me and mine starts distorting my duty, like in the case of Arjuna, or like in the case of Dhritarashtra, then it has to be given up. When my attachments start becoming an obstacle to me performing my duty, then I should give it up. Nirmamo is that attachment which becomes an obstacle in our path to our dharma. The word nirmamo can also be explained as acting without the feeling, what is there in it for me? Right? That's what that is the primary idea that we always have at the top of our mind in whatever we do. So nirmamo is acting without that feeling. So when this selfishness is there, the problem is we will start analyzing every task that is at hand only with this question. Is it useful to me in any way? Will I benefit from it in any way? Someone comes to me and speaks to me. Is there anything I can benefit from this person? Then I will talk to that person in a certain manner. In some situation comes up, if I get involved, what will be my benefit? And then I will decide whether I should get involved or not, right? We don't realize that in this thinking itself is embedded the seed for karma that binds. Because when I speak to a person with the expectation that this person is going to benefit me in the future, I'm already putting out an aspiration in the future, right? And putting out an asha, as Krishna said, he says, do without that aspiration for the future. So when I speak to a person with expectation that this person is going to be useful to me later, I automatically get into that cycle which Krishna spoke about in the second chapter. When he said, Dhyayate Vishyan Bumsaha Sangasteshu Pajayate Sangat Sanjayate Kamaha Kamat Krodo Kroda Abhijayate Krodad Bhavati Sammoha Sammohat Smritis Smriti Vibramaha Smriti Bramshad Buddhi Nasho Buddhi Nashat Pranashyati. So this was a sequence that Krishna had given. The moment you place your desire or a selfish idea in whatever you do, without your knowledge and very, very swiftly, it goes through this entire cycle that you start, it becomes a desire, it starts becoming an attachment, and once it becomes an attachment, there is a chance of you becoming angry or you becoming greedy, and all of that follows one after the other. And eventually the buddhi or the discrimination, which is a very, very precious gift to the human being, is unfortunately kept busy in this low level of discrimination. Do I benefit or do I not benefit? How much do I benefit? How much more can I benefit? This involves a lot of intelligence, right? We all know that. People who probably defraud others, people who get into these massive scams that we always keep hearing about in the corporate world, that calls for immense intelligence. It's not an ordinary person's thinking, right? But when we get lost in this kind of mamatva, we are using this precious discrimination which has been given to us in this low level of thinking. So when the attitude of nirmamo is developed, the discrimination or buddhi is freed for spiritual inquiry. I think just this morning in the afternoon satsang we were talking about this, how it's the same discrimination, the same buddhi, which is used for worldly discrimination as well as spiritual discrimination. And this is the greatest gift to humankind. This is what makes us stand apart from the rest of the animal kingdom. If we were to use this buddhi only for enhancing our luxuries, then we are using something so precious for something so mundane. So when Krishna says that when you are able to act without this feeling of nirashihi nirmamo, you are literally freeing this buddhi so that it can be kept in spiritual thoughts. Another way of putting all these is one must act as an instrument, right? That's what it all comes down to. Not because I want something or, you know, these are my people and I want to benefit them in some manner. When you say that I have been placed in this particular situation by God, I accept it, and because I'm placed here, I am an instrument through whom God will do whatever he wants to do. Let Swami operate through me. And that attitude of being an instrument, it's going to come again and again. This whole concept is going to be spoken of from different angles, because this is the most practical part of the Bhagavad Gita, the Karma Yoga that Krishna teaches, right? So it's going to be revisited many, many times, and we will be repeating it over and over again, because that's the only way it's going to get into our head, right? So one of the ways of putting this whole thing that Krishna has been speaking about is, can we start operating like an instrument? The moment you say that all my actions should be offered to Swami, which means, first of all, you accept that I have been put in this place around these people who, some of them are my colleagues, some of them are my family, some of them are my co-citizens. I have been put in this place for a particular reason, and let me dispense all my actions as my offering to Swami. And when I dispense them, it has to be in a manner that it is acceptable to Swami, to his satisfaction. I'll have to merge my satisfaction with his satisfaction. That's the whole idea, isn't it? And all of this comes along, right? And this is another approach that will automatically come when we do it for God. When we say that I'm offering it, doing it as an offering to God. That is doing it as an instrument. And finally, he adds another word in this verse, in this particular verse. He says, Vigata Jwaraha. Vigata Jwaraha. Without any frustration. Jwara means to be agitated, to be restless. So Vigata Jwaraha means without any frustration. That word more or less can be said to be the touchstone. If I can not be worried about the future, if I can not be obsessed about myself and the people who belong to me, and have my mind fixed on higher things and do whatever I do as an offering to Swami, then I will automatically become Vigata Jwaraha. I will be unagitated. So this is a very, very beautiful summary of what Karma Yoga is all about. We'll go to the next verse, and it's going to be a little bit of an extension of what Krishna is saying here. We'll listen to that. We will discuss as much as time permits us. And mostly the next week we'll start off with this particular verse, because there's much understanding. I might not be telling anything new, but it is always important to repeat this to us again and again, because that's the only way we will start practicing it. Because we keep forgetting this as we go through life. And that's the nature of the mind. It's not that there's something wrong with you or me. That's the nature of the mind. It's just like our physical body. The physical body gets dirty, right? The processes in the body is such that you sweat, and there are other biological processes which happen, which makes this body dirty day after day. And the only way that it can be maintained clean is when you wash it every day. Same is the case with the mind. The mind's nature is to go outward. The mind's nature is to think of itself. So when we act in the world, it is likely to get muddled in this raga, dvesha, karma that we are performing. So the only way to pull it back is to constantly keep reminding it, just like how as long as you're alive, you have to have a bath every day. And right? And similarly, as long as we are operating in this world, these truths have to be reiterated again and again. We'll listen to verse number 31. As I said, we'll discuss as much as we can, and then we'll leave the rest for the next week.
Ye me matamidam nityam anutishthanti manavah shraddhavanto nasuyanto muchyante tepi karmabhihi.
Those men who constantly practice this teaching of mine with faith and without caviling, they too are freed from actions. So that's verse number 31 of chapter 3. So what is required for me to be able to offer my actions to God? In the previous verse, Krishna said, do whatever you do as an offering to me. What does that really mean, and how can I go about doing that? As I mentioned before, the most important thing for that is the quality of faith. Let's say I've worked very, very hard. I've worked an entire lifetime. I've saved a lot of money. There's an amount of savings that I have. And let's say I'm looking to invest that money somewhere. I'm looking at various investment options, investment schemes. There are probably businesses that are looking for investors. And all of these options are in front of me. Why will I choose to invest in something like this? It should offer me a better deal than keeping my savings in one place, in the bank or something like that. A better rate of interest or better turnover or whatever it is. I'm not into that, so I'm not too sure of the terminology and all of that, but you'll get the idea. So I have a lot of money. So is there a scheme by which, by me putting it there, I can make more money than that particular money is sitting in my bank account? So it should give me a better deal. But for me to put the money in any of these schemes or any of these businesses, the other thing which is most important is I must have faith in that particular organization, right? Without that faith, I will not put my hard-earned money into any of these things. Karma Yoga is pretty much like that. I can use all my time and energy to do regular karma. That probably can be compared to keeping money with myself, either in the locker in my house or putting it in a bank. But Krishna comes along and says that you offer your karmas to me and do it in this particular way and use this is the methodology, and I will give you the ultimate return. Ultimate in quotes. He's saying that I will give you the return of the ultimate itself. He's saying I will lead you to the final deliverance. So there is Krishna coming along and saying that here is the offer. So either you keep the money and you get the 4%, 3% interest that your bank gives you, or you offer it to me and do it in such and such a manner, and I will give you this infinite return. So that's why he says that what is most important for that is that you must have faith in his words. And once you start, I must keep at it. I cannot keep pulling out my money every now and then when I want to invest it somewhere. It's basic investment knowledge that the longer you're ready to park your money, the better is going to be your returns. So when I have faith in Krishna's word and I decide to invest my karma in this investment scheme that he's offering me, I cannot keep pulling out my money. I cannot become restless every now and then when returns are not coming. And that's why Krishna says in this particular verse, Ye me matam idam nityam anutishtanti manavaha. He says, Ye matam idam. This teaching of mine, Ye manavaha, those men who nityam anutishtanti, incessantly follow. Shraddhavantaha, people of faith. Anasuyanta, with anasuya. The word anasuya is the antonym of the word asuya. Asuya means actually jealousy, But I think you can also say asuya is the kind of restlessness when you feel that you're not progressing as much as the others are, or you're not having what the others have. So the word anasuya can also be described as not being perturbed by the act of comparison or by looking around. So anasuyanta means without being intolerant or without being restless. So not becoming restless and having faith, you can say, are like two sides of the coin. If I have faith, then I will not become restless, right? I'll be more patient. That's why faith and patience, they say, go hand in hand. So Krishna is saying, ye me matam idam nityam anutishtanti manavaha. Those who are ready to follow this, follow whatever this particular rule that I'm giving, those who are ready to follow it incessantly, shraddhavantaha anasuyantaha, with faith and without restlessness, mucchanti, they will be freed, te api karma bhihi, from karmas. But Krishna says, te api karma bhihi, which means, even they will be freed of karmas. So Krishna is telling that even they, and what is the idea of even they, who else is he referring to in this whole process? In general, we can say that all people can be categorized into three groups. The first one is those that have no clue or aspiration for higher things in life. They are not mumukshus. They do not have an idea of deliverance. They do not have an idea of liberation. They are stuck in this worldly plane. They are only thinking about raga and dvesha, regular karma. I will do to earn, I will do more to earn more, and what I earn, I will save, right? It's in that cycle. The people who have been referred to as ajnanis, avivekis, and all of those terminologies which has been used. A beautiful terminology that we saw this particular week is kritsnavit, right? Akritsnavit, those who do not have the complete vision. So all of these people probably fall into the first category of people. The second group, and of course in no particular order, are the jnanis. The ones like Janaka, whether they act or whether they don't act, it makes no difference because they've reached that kind of a complete wisdom, what we refer to as a jnana nishta. Such people are anyway free from the consequences of action. In fact, they were never bound. Their actions were always coming out of non-doership, so they do not get bound at all. So this is the second category of people, and these are the people who are also freed from action. The third category is that of the karma yogi, or those who are in the path of karma yoga. They have not transcended likes and dislikes already. They still have raga and dvesha. They also have aspirations. They also have fears and insecurities. But now they have an idea of using this karma for a larger purpose, for a higher purpose, right? So they are ready to do whatever they do as an offering to God. And they are ready to be patient, and they are ready to hold their faith in the Lord. So Krishna says, such people, mucchante te api karma bhi, even such people will be freed from karma. So the jnanis are those who are definitely going to be freed from karma. So Krishna says, even these people who are on the path of karma yoga, who are making this effort, which is you and me, hopefully Swami will consider all of us as at least being in the beginning stages of karma yogi, if not as being stalwarts of karma yoga. But at least we have the desire for something higher than just what the world has to offer. And if we are in this process, and whatever Krishna described in this particular verse, where he says in this verse and the verse before that, when you're able to not have aspirations, too much of aspirations, or at least ensure that they do not define your karma, you do not have the feeling of mamatvam, or at least control those feelings of mamatvam which become an obstacle for you to perform your duties. And then Krishna says shraddha and anasuya, which means you do not become restless and you have faith. Somebody who is able to operate like this and goes on to do his or her karma are also freed from karma, is what Krishna says in this particular verse. So we'll conclude, dear listeners, this episode with this assurance that Krishna is doing, that don't worry, you do not have to be a jnani, you do not have to be someone who has transcended raga and dvesha. do it with a feeling that you are doing whatever you're doing as an offering to me. This cannot be, there cannot be a better investment plan than this, better offer than this from Krishna. He's saying even such people will be freed from karma. So with that assurance and with that beautiful confidence-giving statement from Krishna, let's conclude this week's program by offering it at Swami's lotus feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today. I'll join you all again next week, 7:30 p.m., for the continuation of the Triune Pilgrimage of the Gita series. Till then, take care. Jai Sai Ram.
You are listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.